Well, I want to thank Alain and the KITP for inviting me, and I want to retaliate a little bit here because so I can always blame you guys for all these embarrassing questions. Alain wanted me to talk about sex and arrhythmias, and I've already given that talk, and I decided I'd want to do something else, particularly with this very mathematically oriented audience. So I'm putting myself in harm's way here. I realize that. But I'm going to be talking about a problem, an issue that lingered for about 100 years now, and the nature of fibrillation, its structure, and its dynamic. And why would one want to understand fibrillation and its dynamics? And the real reason is that a good portion of us in this room will probably perish from such an arrhythmia, some sort of fibrillation. And it continues to be a major health problem. And the type of Hollywood movie where you see somebody going into the emergency room and there's a successful defibrillation is for the most part fantasy. And my wife attests to that. She's a physician, and this doesn't really work so well. So fibrillation remains a problem, an issue we need to solve and do better with. And perhaps if we understand what makes a heart fibrillate, we can figure out how to help stop that arrhythmia. So the talk is on wavelets, wave breaks, and ventricular fibrillation. I'm going to start by talking about some of the methods used to study fibrillation and fibrillation dynamics, and then talk about some papers that we have published that use those techniques, and some of the controversies that arise from those measurements. And then I would like to proceed on to describe what I think may be an explanation of why some people see a mother rotor and others don't see a mother rotor. And those studies, I think, are online. We just got the paper published. And if we have enough time, and here Alain told me, well, leave the slides in just in case we have time. Depends on the questions and how long it takes. I'd like to show you some new data on isolation and measurements of wave breaks, identifying wave break locations, and what happens in the myocardium at the site where wave breaks occur. And these are new data that we haven't published. So let me start first by talking about mechanism underlying VF. And as you can see, this is a very old problem. A mother rotor hypothesis exists since 1920, where the idea is that there's a dominant focal source which drives the arrhythmia. And it fires at high frequency, maintains the arrhythmia. And this you can study, of course, by imaging now with fluorescence, and discrete regions have dominant frequencies. So the result that convinces people of the existence of these high-frequency focal sources is essentially by analyzing the fast Fourier transform of optical signals. But people had done this even earlier using electrograms and had essentially come to some similar theories and hypotheses as far back as 1920.
How did we think about a rotor at that time? I mean,
with shock electrode recordings. With shock electrode recordings, you can see large regions of ECGs, and you can measure activation very well with the QRS complex. And from those activation, you can now plot, take the fast Fourier transform, and you can see the frequency distribution. And then you can see the large region from an epicardial mapping SOC that says a lot of the heart is going on at that frequency.
Okay, so it was more dominant frequency than a
yes.
Motor.
Well, then the hypothesis is that there is a high frequency focal source which is sending off the wave. The shape is not, yeah. No, he used FFT analysis. He didn't have a description of the full rotor.
He moved the probe from.
Yeah, he could do that. Yes.
But he did the FFT.
He probably only FT.
FTFT. But the point is that the point that is important to make is people trying to identify the nature of fibrillation and whether or not it's organized or a disorganized process. So you can appear to have an organized process by looking at signal analysis and signal processing. You can do it with a number of techniques. But of course, the optical mapping technique and the paper by Zaitsev, Chan, and Sami have really pushed this idea to its most recent zenith, shall we say. Others find that it's a much more complicated situation, that you have dynamics of interactivation intervals that are not compatible with the Motor-Rota hypothesis, and of course the theory of Moe and Gary even earlier, that the fibrillation is essentially a can of worm appearance where you have many events going along in the ventricle in a random fashion and giving it this appearance of uncontrolled, ineffective pumping. Then there are theoretical experiments, and of course we have Alain here who's contributed to that. And we have done some studies, which I'll show you a little bit, about FFT analysis and VF.
One question. I mean, this distinction, of course, is also continuous, because you could still have a heart which is dominated by one thing, it's called a mother rotor, but there might still be some children around, which might be subdominant.
Right, and I will address this very much. The question is that true? Right. And in the SAMI paper, which I will, as I discuss this work, the current idea of a mother rotor is that the mother rotor is anchored on the left ventricle, that it is a very high frequency focal source, and as it drives the rest of the heart and goes towards the right ventricle, the right ventricle cannot keep up at those frequencies, and so you have what is called fibrillatory conduction, where you have some waves making it through to the right and some failing to make it through, and so you have there the complicated appearance of multiple frequency distributions that occur at that boundary and on the right ventricle. So that's in fact the people who believe in the mother rotor hypothesis are claiming that you see both in the same heart.
But the dominant structure is the mother.
And the dominant structure encompasses, and the important point here is that the dominant structure encompasses a very large area or volume of the heart. In this, the case of the guinea pig heart, is virtually the whole left side, the left free wall, which is really the major part. And that's what drives the fibrillation. So, that's correct. In no case have they argued that the mother rotor encompasses all of the heart. There's always areas of fibrillatory conduction where the FFT is more complex. So, in effect, people have now talked about this fibrillation in terms of how can we reconcile the fact that some people see mother rotor and others don't, and a tale of two fibrillations, a paper that was written by the Pen Shen group, argued that you may initially start with a complex fragmented wavelets which consists of the constant creation and annihilation of waves, and then as the heart becomes more and more ischemic in the animal, you then start to transform this to different types of fibrillations, and then type 2 fibrillation, which they claimed is now a mother rotor appearance, which becomes highly organized. And then fibrillation, if it is highly organized, then it's a different substrate on how to break that arrhythmia and how to deal with a highly organized VF, as opposed to a very complex, multi-segmented, multi-frequency, and very short-lived set of re-entry spirals or wavelets, okay? And so it became the issue here to determine to what extent that is true. Now, in the tale of two fibrillation, it's very important to point out that what the Pen Shen group describes is a heart in the animal, open chest, you induce the fibrillation, and you see the multiple changes that occur. And they quote the work of Wiggers et al., And what Wiggersdal did is he took a movie camera and took pictures. He had just celluloid film in those days and looked at all the different phases and says there are lots of phases. This is a very dynamic process. And so they argue that these two components of fibrillation are seen as a function of time. One appears and then the other appears. And so they try to reconcile the discrepancy of these two. But it's important to know that this is an intact animal where the fibrillation causes a loss of blood pressure, loss of flow, and an ischemia. And in that case, absolutely, ischemia is antifibrillatory. And there are papers that have already shown that. Severe ischemia, you can rarely fibrillate. This is not a good recommendation on how to stop fibrillation, right? But you can't argue that ischemia is really what's going on here in the Wigger kind of movie. And in the type of experiments that we do on the guinea pig, we are also aware that fibrillation is very dynamic and is going to change as a function of time. But what we try to do is perfuse it in a highly oxygenated solution, maintain flow rate. So we don't just maintain pressure because you could have vascular changes in the vessel. So if you use a pressure head to perfuse your heart, well, you may have different levels of flow through the vessels if the coronaries shut down and open up. So by keeping a constant flow pressure system, by keeping everything oxygenated, you can get now a fibrillation that is sort of a quasi-steady state that lasts a long time, and it isn't dynamically changing so quickly. And that's what the SAMI group and the Syracuse group have done, and they see mother rotors, and we don't. Okay? So there's still a difference.
So you're differentiating between constant pressure and constant flow?
Yes.
And you're doing?
Constant flow.
Constant flow.
Right.
Infinite pressure, basically.
Sorry?
Pressure doesn't matter anymore because it's constant. The pressure can be anything.
Well, that's an exaggeration if you say that. Because if the pressure becomes so high, if, for example, my vessels clamp up and seal, okay, then the pressure head that I need to apply is going to cause all kinds of problems, okay? So it doesn't happen. So there may be variations in the guinea pig heart, which you can perfuse as 60 to 80 millimeters of mercury aortic pressure, and it may oscillate up and down by 5 or 10 millimeters of mercury under these conditions, but the flow remains constant. So the oxygen delivery and the removal, like catabolic products, or is not changing.
Whether it's the flow through main arteries?
Yes, through the aorta.
Through the aorta?
Yes.
Which doesn't exclude that small capillaries might shut
down? Almost certainly excludes it. But that's not from the actual signals that you get throughout the heart. Because the quality of the signals start to change and triangulate. But in the fibrillation, yes. I mean, how far do things change during the time course of one of the experiments? It's not likely to change a lot, but does it not change at all? I cannot say. There is almost certainly some metabolic changes that are happening gradually. And metabolic changes cannot be neglected or ignored. Because the first thing, of course, that requires the most metabolic energy is calcium handling, and we all know all about calcium problems and what impact they might have on an arrhythmia or on all of the things we've been talking about. So, how do people study VF? First, you can say that you look at spatial distribution, and what we were interested in it trying to understand in the fibrillation, when you look at interactivation intervals in the fibrillatory heart, does this depolarization and repolarization lose all information of what the refractory period of the tissue used to be before the arrhythmia? We were intrigued by the fact that in a fibrillation, you have depolarization and repolarization events that are occurring at completely abnormal high rates. And the heart at each point on the ventricle has a different repolarization feature. We know that the apex repolarization is faster, and action potential durations are shorter, and at the base they are longer. When the heart fibrillates, what happens? Is there an equal, does all of this baseline feature of the underlying substrate go out the window, or does even the fibrillating heart retain some of these cellular properties that are there before the fibrillation? So in Choi and Allen Cirque research 2001, we found that the interactivation intervals in the fibrillating heart was related and linked to the refractory period at that part of the heart before fibrillation. Sure.
You see, special distribution, it's two-dimensional,
what kind of... It's two-dimensional, and I will show that in a minute. I will show that data. I'm telling you what I'm going to show you right now. So, yes, it's a two-dimensional distribution, and I will show it. And another issue here is time-frequency distribution analysis, and we were trying to use FFT, but now in the next step, not only in frequency domain, but in the time domain. And time frequency domain analysis is an approach to look at fibrillating events as they occur and try to characterize them. Another question that we were concerned about is that in the fibrillating heart, what happens to cell-cell coupling? Are the gap junctions still active, open? Is there communication between one part of the heart that's fibrillating and an adjacent part that's fibrillating? And how do we get a handle on that? And that we study time lag cross-correlation analysis, and I will show you that. And then here we try to understand why some people see mother rotor and others don't. And finally, this wave break story. So first let me tell you about our model. We use a Langendorf perfused guinea pig heart. We do not use electrochemical uncouplers of any kind. And in the first part of the study, we simply used a photodiode array 16 by 16 because the quality of the signal and signal-to-noise ratio allows you to do a lot of things at the expense of spatial resolution. And later on, I will show you other stuff with higher spatial resolution. So these are the raw optical traces at every location on that guinea pig heart. And this is 1.6 centimeter to give you an idea of the dimensions of what we're looking at. And this is the left descending. And so you're looking at the right, the left. And that's a very convenient part of the heart to look at, mainly because you're getting left information, right information, you're getting apex information and base information all in one image. This also happens to be a very convenient part of the heart to look at because that surface is rather flat. If you go on the other side and you try to image here, the curvature here is much more pronounced. And so for technical reasons, you have to try to get a uniform flat field in order to image. And so I image at fairly narrow depth. And so we believe we are looking at two-cell, three-cell layers, no more, on the surface because of the illumination that we use. And we have a chamber that has been described. I didn't bring a slide of it, but on how we eliminate motion artifact by essentially getting signals that are so much greater than the motion artifact that the motion artifact itself is becoming insignificant to the analysis. So this is a fibrillating signal, and this is the FFT at each site. And yes?
So this is without glass plate.
Yeah, there is a glass plate. Yes, there is. There's a window and there's a chamber. There's not...
Slightly pushed against the heart.
Yes. In fact, not only is the heart on a glass plate, it's inside a sealed chamber. So the heart is surrounded by solution. The solution is maintained at 37 degrees. There's a heater in the chamber, and then the temperature of the ringer comes in at a very well feedback loop system to maintain temperature. And why we think that's very important? Because action potential durations from here to here are heterogeneous, and action potential duration is highly dependent on temperature. And if we do not keep a stable temperature throughout, we're going to get a big mess. Okay? And we have checked that by putting a thermistor all along the surface here and recording temperature, and to make sure that we are with half a degree centigrade everywhere on the area that we're recording from. So if you look at an FFT and you plot frequencies, and now this is your question, right? You were asking me about what we were doing on this.
No, sorry, I have another question. So, is it possible technically to make the view not on this front view, but from maybe two sides? Or?
Yes, and people have done that. Yeah, they call that panoramic mapping. And there you map all around. Mark Lin and John Wixwo were the first ones to try this in a very ingenious way. What they did is they put two mirrors in the back of the heart so that you see an image of the back and then the image from the front, and they have a camera. And then the camera takes a picture of the front of the heart and then the reflections from the back. And in one shot, you can get the front and the hidden side of the moon, right? Catastrophically poor, yes. That's a problem. But another thing you can do is put lots of cameras around. And so you have to redesign this approach. But it's not, it's just money. It's just cost. It's not, okay. So, but your first question is even more interesting to me. So your first question was, if I look at a map of the heart on the surface of the anterior surface, this is the apex and this is the base, this is the right ventricle, this is the left, and I measure now action potential durations. They're short at the apex, and the isochrone lines show they go from short to long systematically across the surface of the heart. Now, I superimpose on this a map of frequencies that you measure from the different sites on the heart. And what you find is that the interactivation intervals and the frequencies are lower where the action potential durations were longer and the refractory period was larger, and the frequencies to go higher and higher where the older refractory period is shorter. And this is not too surprising, because this fibrillating heart is depolarizing and repolarizing, and the ionic channels important for repolarization have to be the same that produce repolarization in a normal downstroke. And the reason why there are differences in action potential duration is because there are differences in population number of these potassium channels. There's more IKR current in the apex of the heart than the base of the heart. So if you can now repolarize faster, you're going to drop that signal and you can have faster fibrillation. You can't have very fast fibrillation if you can't bring the voltage back down to depolarize again.
So the APTs are measured with this curvature idea, or how do you measure the APT?
APD?
Yes.
Oh, we measured it with the second derivative approach that I was telling you about at your office.
Curvature.
Yes. Second derivative.
You take the second derivative of the time signal.
Oh, right. Of the APD. Right. Yes, the frequency, of course, is not. It's just the frequency. Yeah. Okay, now I take you to time frequency domain distribution. One of the things that you want to know is, in the fibrillating heart, if you take any time section, say you take a 2-second interval of an arrhythmia, of a VF, and you take the fast Fourier transform, you find a distribution of frequencies. What happens here is that you lose all information with respect to time. When did that frequency event occur in that 2-second interval? You have no clue. If you look at the fibrillation in time, you don't have frequency information. So what do people do? They use what is called short-time FFT. In short-time FFT, you take a 2-second segment, you produce the FFT, then you move it again, you shift by half a millisecond, you repeat the FFT, and you keep going like this across the fibrillation, and you can analyze 14 to 18 milliseconds. This is a 14 second spectrograph of the fibrillating heart. This is one diode, one detector, and it's recording the fibrillation in a 1 by 1 millimeter roughly area of heart. And you can see the frequency, the FFT here, but what this tells you is how the frequencies change as a function of time, and there's a certain amount of blurring. So it's standard signal processing to tighten up this haziness that you have because of the shifting as you go across is to use a cone-shaped kernel, and what you get is a spectrogram of the frequencies that you have at that spot on the heart as a function of time. And what you see is that you have some frequencies appear here, some here, and here. Well, is there a continuum? No, because here and here, this appears out of nowhere. So you suddenly have an event going on at a certain frequency right here. And here you have two events going on. This one disappears, and this one appears, and so on. So what you see from this are fibrillation events that appear and disappear in time, and you can see that they also coexist in time. Okay?
Normal action potential duration in the guinea pig
heart? So if you do a, say, 500 millisecond cycle length, the action potential duration would be 200 milliseconds.
And is this 16 hertz or 1.6?
16.
So that's
fast. That's very fast for a guinea pig.
Okay.
It's not a mouse. But even for a mouse, that would be pretty good. But even here, the lower end, 10-12, is pretty fast.
Does that correspond to actual action potentials at that point in space?
No, some people call them action potentials, and I'm reluctant to call them action potentials because they don't have the shape of an action potential.
I see.
They go up and down. The trace, here they are. That's what you see. These are the signals.
I can't see.
This is compacted. Yes. But they're not action potentials in the true sense of the world. But they are depolarizing and repolarizing. There's no plateau phase.
How much smoothing do you get from the die at this frequency of 16 hertz?
Smoothing from the die? None.
Is it enough? It's none.
No, none. Oh, so you need to know that the voltage-sensitive die can, under voltage clamp condition, is as fast as the voltage clamp, which is about microsecond range. Okay, and that's a very important point.
But you're integrating over a little area.
Yes. Yes, we are integrating over a little area. That's right.
So what does this algorithm do with the, you know, you can test all these algorithms on a computer simulation. You don't have to get every heart, right? And you could just imagine you take any model which makes a two-dimensional map, and then you know pretty much what the waveform really is, and then you can test these models. So what happens at a shock when you have two waves collide?
That's the end of the talk, towards the end. I will show that at higher resolution for that. Because this is too low a resolution.
Right, that's what I was wondering.
This resolution is too low to measure wave front and wave breaks.
Well, but also what happens is, you know, it still assumes a Fourier transform, which assumes a limited domain, and then by making it finite, you kind of put in a window, and so things are being introduced on the way that might change the data, the interpretation. So one has to be, of course, if you always do the same thing, then you're on safe grounds because you're...
No. And bear with me 1 second, because when I talk about wave breaks, we do not use this analysis.
I understand. Oh, okay. There are wave breaks in this data.
Yes.
This data has been analyzed in the way the wave breaks are not taken.
Well, but you can get different kinds of information here. We're not going to get wave break information here.
When you interpret this data, you have to always keep in mind how it was analyzed. That's what I'm saying.
Absolutely. But I'm trying to explain how we did the analysis so there is no confusion about all of the pitfalls. It's important. Yes?
Is there anything from the amplitude? I mean, this is optical signal.
Yes.
So is there any way you can sort of like draw back what voltages?
Absolute voltages. I can only infer this very... It's difficult. Okay, so before I got defibrillation, I had an action potential, a normal looking action potential. And I know that the normal looking action potential started somewhere below here and went up to here. And that's really all I know. And that action potential, I can take it to the bank and tell you that it was most likely minus 85 to plus 10 millivolts in the guinea pig. And I know that because if it's ischemic, it will change. And right away, if it's there is any kind of problem with the pathology of the tissue at that site, the shape of the action potential changes, and then the numbers that I gave you from minus 85 plus 10 are no longer valid. Okay? But as long as the action potential duration is nice and healthy, I have a good plateau, if you did the experiment by impaling with an electrode, and you would repeat that experiment and average it out, you would get that number. And the voltage sensitive valve gives it to you with much less effort. Okay? And how do we know that it's true? Because we did co-experiments where you use a microelectrode and the optics at the same time and compared the two. And you can put them on top of each other, superimpose them. This is older stuff. I didn't bring those slides because already we're not going to finish. Okay? But you can look them up, or I may have something in my computer. Okay? So the question is, do I know the absolute voltage and the potentials? I cannot be certain. I can only estimate. And it's not realistic for me to put a microelectrode at the same time as I do these experiments. Certainly not on 256 sites simultaneously. But let me move on a little bit. So from these experiments, I can start to look at, in fact, let me just go right away to this one. And, how do I start the movie?
One more back,
oh, that's right, because I had an automatic, sorry. Okay, so if you now take these short time FFT analysis, and you say, whenever I have a pixel on this XY plane, where I see an event where the same pixels have the same frequency, I then group them and give them a color. The color is completely arbitrary, right? It's just to allow you to see that these pixels having a fibrillating event at that frequency. And another spot is having another event at a different frequency. So these are coexisting. There is overlap. So the same part of the heart on the XY plane can be going on at more than one event. And those are essentially fibrillation events. They have a certain, the only thing they have in common from this analysis is their frequency. Okay? And then we added nifedipine to block the calcium, the voltage-gated calcium current. And when you do that, you completely change the nature of these fibrillating events. So these are essentially turned into a ventricular tachycardia, as you will see, and it will have a very nice score right at the center, and is going to go up at a high frequency, right? Because this is the z-axis is your frequency scale. Vincent.
How do you distinguish the bending signal from the arrhythmias?
From what?
From the arrhythmias, because here you have 10 to 25 terms or a nonlinear signal.
What we did is essentially, just a second.
Of course.
We get it from here. As a function of time. And you generate a movie. So if this is a harmonic of that, right, you would see a periodicity relationship. There isn't. Okay? Yes, please.
Have you also looked at, so right now you look at the dominant frequency of the slow Fourier transform?
All the frequencies. We look at all the frequencies, not just a dominant frequency.
What do you mean all the frequencies?
We find that at any one spot on the heart, We have a very complex FFT. It has all, it has different frequencies. In the movie, we don't think that the energy of the amount of energy you have at that frequency is necessarily indicative of that being more important than any other frequency.
So
we're pulling all of them.
But you clip them, because this way you can get discrete frequencies, otherwise it's continuum.
Right. With the spectrograph, we separate them.
We just keep them. Just right. Anything that's above a certain limit, I plot, and everything that's below a certain...
Oh, yeah, and yeah, right. There's nothing down here. Yes.
Right. You basically clip that, and that's how five peaks peaking through.
Right.
It's not important for me, but I don't know. So what you're doing is, I basically put a line across here, basically, effectively, perhaps with a different method. And then say everything that's above here, I plot on this plot as a vertex.
Well, there is a threshold, and the threshold we use is 3 times the standard deviation. So, because that's such a small thing, we can't be sure it's significant.
That's why this
but
is
it's
why the rest is small.
Right. Okay, and if you analyze these events...
When you pick 2 seconds for this finite time entry, why not 1 second? Or
you try that. We try different intervals. In effect. And so how does it go? There is a rule about this in the signal processing literature, and I need to remember it now because it was a while ago, that as you shorten the time interval, you lose frequency resolution. It's a bit like a Heisenberg principle, and if you increase your time of analysis, you lose some time resolution and you gain frequency resolution. So there is obviously a balance between the two.
But that balance could be set by some...
Right, there is a criteria. Right. There is a criteria to do that. And it's in the paper.
Okay.
And I don't remember it now. But we did try. We did try and compared. If you analyze 1 second at a time and moved along, first of all, the computational time took really long. And even after, and you have to apply the cone-shaped kernel to tighten up the resolution, and it didn't make a lot of difference to the outcome. The outcome being, ultimately, that fibrillation is a set of events that are very short-lived. These are the half-life analysis of fibrillating events. 3.9 seconds, they last 3.9 seconds on average. And you have events that are coexisting. They appear and disappear randomly. And we cannot really identify that there is a continuum of one frequency drifting into another frequency. And that, of course, would have been if that was happening, then you would imply by that perhaps there is a dominant focal source that is driving all of these arrhythmias. But because there was no continuum from one frequency event to a different frequency event, it seemed to come out and go away, you can't really link that. Okay. Now let me move on to another type of analysis. Are we ready before I go on?
Why are you talking about continuum? Why continuous change of frequencies is indicative for?
Well, if it's a meandering spiral as it moves, right? And goes throughout the heart intramurally, there's three dimension. If there's a meandering rotor, you could see it change its frequency gradually.
Yes.
Okay, that's what I mean by that. Okay? So another type of analysis that we did is cross-correlation analysis. And here, in its simplest form, you take one diode, let's say the center of the heart, and you see voltage depolarizations and repolarization that are going on at a very high rate. Okay, so there's all the complexities of these different events, and we don't know what they are. And then we ask the question, if you look at the signal here and the signal to the nearest neighbor, and I apply a correlation. I just overlay the two signals and say, how well are they correlated? I can get essentially a plot of how it correlates with essentially something from minus one to one, minus one being exact opposite phase, one is perfect correlation, right? And then, so here's an example of the superposition of the signals across here, and this is the reference point, and I compare how the cross-correlation of the signals relate as I go along this horizontal line of diodes. And you can see when you line them up at first, okay, and then they're not the same, okay? I don't expect them necessarily to be the same. This is a fibrillation. Now, you measure the correlation, and then you shift the time of each one of these diodes relative to the reference until you get a maximum correlation, okay? So if, for example, what you see at a neighboring diode, the nearest neighbor, then the second, the third, and so on, is related to the initial one, but there's a time delay as it travels, as it propagates, if there's some sort of communication delay, then by using time lag cross-correlation, you try to determine the time it takes to obtain maximum cross-correlation. Okay, good. I see some heads, so I can move on. And if you do that, you see something very interesting. This was the reference, and then we measure correlation. And the correlation goes from high to low, and it has this anisotropy built into it. This is in fibrillation. And the moment we saw this, we said, wait a second, I know what that is. That's what I would get if I pace the heart at the center of the left ventricle, because the fibers are anisotropic and conduction velocity is faster along fiber axis and shorter, slower transverse. So in the fibrillating heart, if you do time lag cross-correlation analysis, I think it tells you pretty strongly. Here, this is 0.1 and so on. These are ISO levels of cross-correlation. And this is millisecond waves time delay in propagation during an activation wavefront. Okay? Now, if this is true, then if you look at a careful analysis and you measure the angle, it's exactly the angle that you get along the long axis of the fibers in the guinea pig heart. And this is the average of 6 hearts, and it's a pretty tight. I mean, considering biological variation from guinea pig to guinea pig and the fibrillation dynamics. You can also look at the anterior, right? You can look at the left ventricle and the right ventricle in different parts of the heart. So if you rotate it, the fiber orientation is different in different parts of the heart. And to make sure that this wasn't some fantasy, we did that as well. And here, the star is where we use as a reference for the cross-correlation analysis. And indeed, the fiber orientation is changing depending on what part of the heart you look at. More of the same. This is the right ventricle is this way. The left ventricle actually is the same kind of data that you saw before. So,
I've been worried if you didn't find that, right? Because it's just, I mean, in a continuous excitable medium, this anisotropy is just about the rescaling of space, which is going to rescale any measurements, any function, cross-correlation, propagation.
Right.
They all get rescaled the same.
So I'm glad you feel that way, because now you can trust the other stuff I'm going to tell you, where you're not so sure. I'm trying to bring in the goodwill and confidence. That's why I'm showing this. Otherwise, I wouldn't bother.
Would you say that's as a measure of the space constant? I mean, it's going to take, I mean, we're expecting to put your within the space constant in each other to, you know, to keep moving up and down together. You know, as you, so the quantities are, you know, these the major and minor axes, you perhaps measure some multiple of the space constant in each direction.
It is. Okay. Yeah.
Are you going to claim it's more than that, I guess?
No, I'm just going to claim that the fibrillating heart is retaining essentially cell-cell coupling, very much like what you see in the intact heart before the fibrillation. The gap junctions aren't doing anything unexpected or unknown.
So
that's all.
Yet, right?
That's all I'm going to say about that.
This is not ischemic yet, right?
No. This is perfused, constant flow, fully oxygenated. Yes.
You could have had different domains under control of different rotors in the heart. So I disagree with what
Happened. Right. So if you have a cross correlation where one rotor is in fact, and if you look at 2003 paper, you will get, instead of a continuum, I was going to get to that right here.
Okay. Yes.
If you measure correlation as a function of distance and you get a smooth relationship, it's indicative of, in fact, not a mother rotor. A mother rotor, you would expect step jumps. And you can think about that. And yes.
The anisotropy, no matter what's happening, the image, the anisotropy will show up. I mean, this is what Anil said. Anil said, you know, if you have, no matter what this image will look like, you know, whether the gray scales are like the way you had them in the figure before.
Right, but you could.
The anisotropy has to show up. I mean, it just has to show up. That's what was your point, right?
Right, but in
different, but
yes, but what Leon is saying is also correct, that if you now look at this relationship of correlation as
a, I didn't understand what Leon was saying. Can you tell me what you understood of what Leon was saying?
No. I'm not going to go there. I'm going to move on.
The previous picture, he didn't explain that.
Or maybe Leon can re-explain what he
was saying. But that was Leon's question, and that was the answer to what he was saying. So that was my answer.
But you said it should have steps. You said it should have, I wouldn't have steps.
So if, all right, here we go. Leon, they're forcing my hand. This is what Leon said. Don't blame it on me. He said, if you have a mother rotor in the field and you do a cross-correlation, the cross-correlation will be dominated by the driver of the focal source in the mother rotor. And as you go across from using, let's say, the mother rotor, you don't know where the focus is, right? It's somewhere. But someplace near the focus or away from it, you start correlating the trace away from it or towards it. There's going to be a high degree of correlation, which is really independent or less dependent on fiber orientation, because the rotor is driving all of these signals, right? So you would then see a step of high correlation driven by the rotor, and then if there's another, then you go to a different region of the heart and maybe driven by a different rotor, then you get another step, and then a third, and so on, depending on how many rotors you have in your field of view, driving your field of view. And so Leon is quite correct. When you write the mathematics for that, if you have two rotors, let's say, the cross-correlation, the time-lag cross-correlation, will show high degree of correlation of all the signals that are dependent on that focal source.
And then you go from that shock to the other rotor,
right,
to the other source.
And then the, but there should be discontinuities. No, and we don't see discontinuities. That was the last slide. You do not see discontinuities. That's this one.
May I suggest an alternative interpretation?
Sure.
There are discontinuities, but they change with time. So when you sort of average it out, they produce this fuzzy picture, so you don't see them.
Well, then you have to go back to what we mean by a mother rotor. The mother rotor is very stable. And it's highly organized, and in the reports of by Sammy et al., they last hours. And their frequency is very tight. It just doesn't, it's only one frequency. They call it the dominant frequency. So when that happens, that's not going to play into your issue here. Okay? As a function of time, it's very stable.
Well, there are two things.
If it is a rotor.
Where is the rotor? Is it stable or is it not? And second, what happens to the rest of the tissue?
Right.
There are two different issues. what I'm talking
about. Well, no, not
the tissue can, the properties can vary in time. So the places where you have the discontinuity, the red dot bump.
Okay, that's because that's not how we think of the rotor. The way people think of the mother rotor is that you have a focal source that's very fast, and it drives the rest of the tissue over a large area of the tissue at that same frequency. So the frequency map...
What you see on the surface is not necessarily part of that.
But that's what I'm measuring. I'm measuring the surface.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
This is also averaged, if there are several domains with rotors, you know, this is averaged over all those domains too, is that right? So
the issue of the size of the mother rotor is snafu here, because the mother rotor is supposed to take up the whole left ventricle. The fact that I have a 0.9 by 0.9 millimeter area isn't going to hide a mother rotor if I'm averaging out over that. But even then, within that pixel, I should see one frequency. I don't. I see many frequencies at the same time. So you can't go with that. But I will defend this even more thoroughly in the next set of data, if I may. Okay?
But it is true, of course, that you know all this idea can be checked with a 2D simulation where you see
about the steps,
order,
yeah,
and then you can just see whether it comes out or not.
Right.
More experimentally.
Okay. Clues to different VF dynamics. So this I already mentioned. Ischemia explained multiple wavelet versus dominant frequency. In the tail of two fibrillations, ischemia could have explained that, but we're not doing an ischemic heart, and so it cannot explain that. But we have other ideas of what explains that. And one of them is the swelling of myocardium under perfusion in constant flow rate and hypoosmotic solution. So here I apologize. I'm going to take all the theorists to physiology, and they're going to be very upset at me. But when you perfuse a heart in crystalline solution, meaning sodium chloride, a little calcium, a little potassium, you are not mimicking the normal physiological state of the heart in the body. One of the things that's in bloodstream is albumin. And albumin has a very important role in maintaining tonicity of the cells. Let me explain. The cells have mainly potassium inside and very large proteins. And these proteins are membrane impermeable, and they act as osmotically active particles. And the tendency, therefore, is to draw water into the cell until the number of osmotically active particles inside the cell and outside the cell are equal. When you add a crystalline solution in your perfusion, you don't have any impermeable particles outside, because virtually all the components that you have, the sodium chloride, potassium chloride, and so on, have leakage pathways, and they have channel pathways which can equilibrate. So in classic physiology, you see people add albumin, right, which is what in serum, which is in our blood, in order to act as an osmotically active particle to balance the high protein content inside the cell and maintain the volume of the cell constant. If you perfuse with crystalline solution alone, you don't have that osmotic balance and the cells swell up. We are particularly sensitive to this issue because if we start an experiment, and this is something I did and then just totally forgot about it. If I put the heart in my chamber and I perfuse it in crystalline solution without adding any albumin or other non-permeable solute in the ringers, I see the heart swell up and get bigger and bigger, and finally I can't even fit it in the chamber. And I have a problem, I can't continue the experiment. And of course, when the heart swells to that extent, you're changing a lot of things. Needless to say, your experiment isn't worth much. So I took it upon myself to add an osmotically active particle, and I've been using dextrose. Why? Well, because nobody asks. You add 50 millimolar, normally people add 5 millimolar dextrose, 10 millimolar dextrose as a substrate for energy metabolism. But the heart doesn't run on glycolytic metabolism, it runs on oxidative metabolism, mitochondrial metabolism, which requires phospholipids and oxygen. So the glucose metabolism and glycolysis is a very minor component of its energy substrates. So 5 millimolar would be plenty as far as adding glucose to the solution. We add 50 because it's a cheap way to balance the osmolarity. And when you do that, that's 5. Dextrose is 5 millimolar. Most people use 5 or 10. We use 50. 50.
How long is the time cost? The time that you say that it grows, that the cell is like growing?
Swelling.
How long was
it? I will show you all that. I'm just setting up the...
Do you show us as a function of dextrose concentration?
No, I won't do that. That's too much work. But I will show you the time course.
So how bad is 5 out of your perspective?
Sorry?
That's the question, you know, factor of 10 in dextrose. What does it, everybody else seems to be...
I will show that. This is the whole point, yes. Right. So, cell volume is... Now I need to tell you a little more before I move on. Let me tell you a little more. Cells regulate their volume with channels that are called the chloride volume-sensitive channel. And there's a big controversy in terms of exactly which chloride channel is found in the heart. But all heart in atrial cells, ventricular cells, have chloride channels that open up upon cellular swelling. And that means you have an increased component of chloride conductance that you didn't have before. At rest, in a normal isotonic, isoosmotic condition, the cell is under its normal volume. There is only a very weak activation of these chloride channels. And there's a number of people who are leading researchers in this area, Joe Hume and William Hatton at the University of Nevada, and Baumgarten in Richmond, Virginia. And we talk to them a lot for that reason. So what happens is that if the heart is under a hypotonic or hypoosmotic situation, the cells start to swell and that chloride current opens up and increases. People have looked at the distribution of these chloride channels in the guinea pig heart, and there are some differences, there are species differences, but within the guinea pig heart, these channels are there. So what I'm going to show you is what happens when you perfuse the heart in normal solution with normal tonicity and low tonicity. And what happens if you block that chloride current, which is initiated by a hypotonic, hypoosmotic condition? Okay?
Is there anything evidence that people who perfuse the heart as well, like Geithner or other people, do they see completely different type of perfusion?
I don't know. They dilute their blood. They don't put normal 100% hematocrit. They lower it, I believe. It's very hard to do the experiment with blood because when you add the dye goes everywhere on the red blood cells, the white blood cells, and so on. So almost no one uses whole blood. Bill Clusen uses 50. I'm more familiar with Bill Clusen's attempts. I don't know what Zaitsev is doing. I don't remember. But Bill Clusen does see very big differences in the experiments that he does. And he argues that it's very important to repeat all the measurements we are doing in blood-perfused organs. Yes?
Second question, other than the glucose content, obviously the thyroid solution doesn't have from blood.
Right.
So one big issue is are we working under hypoxic conditions because you don't have
the... We're not. Because I measured the myoglobin oxy-deoxy spectrum. If you are low oxygen, your myoglobin has an iron heme, and the iron heme has two absorption peaks. One is at 560, one is at 580 when it's oxygenated. When it deoxygenated, these two peaks come down, and one in the middle at 570 comes up. That's in my PhD thesis so long ago, but yes, I did that. So 100% oxygenation. Under these conditions, you have enough oxygen delivery. Certainly in the guinea pig and the rabbit, the rat, small animals. In the dog, people complain that that's not true. And we can talk about that later if you're interested, because I think it's not so much a matter of oxygenation, but it has to do with the nature of the perfusion pump. But we can talk about the dog later. But your point is, no, I've done those controls.
So basically, the idea here is that by increasing the dextrose, you change the osmotic pressure
right.
on the cells. Has that been investigated systematically? And like, I mean, I'm sure the cell size doesn't really correlate that 100% because all these channels of the lung, so it's much more complicated than just cell, right? Because there's ionic current, and ions get exchanged. Because the cell doesn't want to stop, probably.
So what you ask is very complicated.
That's what I mean.
And
it's
what?
Really complicated.
It's complicated because, okay, how to best? Some cells, when you put them under a solution condition that swells them, mm-hmm. are able to adjust and come back very close to their original cell volume through ion channel openings. Others cannot. They don't do a good job of volume adjusting. The heart isn't very good at it, as it turns out. But other cells are.
So what that means is you can correlate the size. So take a CD cell where you take a little tiny piece of tissue out
right.
of your heart, you put it under these perfusion conditions, and you can measure the size of the cells, and then
you could. I haven't done that. I haven't done that. But you know, I can look at the heart. It's well.
Sure, it would be highly correlated.
And there's a lot of yes. Well, is it linear? No, I don't know.
Yeah. I'm not saying how it's going to be.
Right. And then you already asked me a very important question: is did you systematically change the osmolarity and tonicity? And the answer is we haven't done that. We've done other things, but I haven't done that. Right. And so that would be what you're. That would be the kind of experiment you like to see, and I don't have that to show you.
But it could be done on a very small piece of tissue, right? I mean, something you put under the microscope, you measure the size of the cells.
Yes, you could. Yes.
Some kind of microscopy.
Right. You. It is a project. Yes. Right. Okay, so in the data I'm going to show you now, with respect to this osmolarity, what we did is we used a saline solution, and then we supplemented that saline solution with mannitol. And the reason why we chose mannitol is because it's essentially what is used in cerebral edema, in the clinical situation. So if any of you ever have this misfortune, they will treat you with mannitol to reduce brain swelling. And it's FDA approved and all of that stuff. Okay, so mannitol is doing what? It's completely inert as far as we know. It is not membrane permeable, right? And acts as a, you know, just as an osmotically active molecule. So we went ahead and looked at that. But first let me show you what happens to a control, and that's a solution with mannitol, and this is without mannitol. And at first, you just don't see that much of a difference in terms of changes in the electrical activity. You see a slight shortening of action potential duration. That's all, at first. Okay, 133 to 157 under control, and this is the map of repolarization.
What is the chloride reversal potential?
The chloride reversal potential is around minus 30, roughly. So it would be it will be flipping during the phase of the action potential, Good question. So this is what happens if you repeat this kind of analysis with respect to FFT in a guinea pig heart fibrillating. And we induce the fibrillation just like we did before using a little burst of pulses. On the right ventricle, you have this complex FFT, low to high frequencies. And you then add, you shift to a minus 45 millimolar mannitol. So here you have mannitol, here you are now hypoosmotic and hypotonic. It doesn't change much. But look at what happens to the left ventricle. The frequencies not only become very different, but you have a very sharp dominant frequency, and look at how high it is. It's close to 30 hertz, which is essentially what the SAMI paper from the Syracuse group see. And it's on the left, and it's not on the right. And that's also what the Syracuse group sees. So if you look at the same thing, and now you add an inhibitor of the chloride swell, or the chloride volume-sensitive channel, then you go from complex FFT on the left ventricle, single dominant frequency, and then back. So it appears that that chloride current has a big effect on the structure of the VF that you get. So this is the time course of how the FFT is changing in time. And this doesn't happen instantaneously. It takes 15, 20 minutes to shift from one type of VF to another type of VF when you change the tonicity of your solution. And it's reversible by blocking the chloride current. So this is an experiment where you have hypoosmotic 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and then you block. But the frequencies here go up quite a bit within 20 minutes, and then go back down. I'm sorry. Yeah, this is the right. Here is what I should point to. Mm-hmm.
So the hypoosmotic means without monitor?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So what was different is that we used dextrose, and we didn't want to redo all this with dextrose because the implication is maybe high dextrose is doing something else.
Well,
that's why I use mannitol instead of dextrose. But I think it's completely the same.
What happens to people that get this fibrosis when they have brain problems? Does the heart...
The heart?
Does the heart do anything
different? Usually it's in the carotid and they try to deliver, but yeah. Yeah, it goes eventually, yeah. Maybe the cells shrink a little bit, I know, I'm not sure. I don't know. It's a good...
Well, if somebody's fibrillating, but they haven't tried to give mannitol.
Right. Yeah.
Have they tried that? No,
they have not, as far as I know.
Why is there this difference between the left and the right?
I'm coming to that. Yes. Okay, so that was exactly the next question. And so we started to look at the literature for spatial heterogeneities of chloride channel expression. And people had already found some differences. So we went to Hatton and Hume, and we used, the CLC3 is the gene that produces the channel itself. The CLC3 volume regulated channel is the isoform that we believe is in the heart, in the guinea pig heart. So there was a bit of controversy about which channel is responsible for that current in the guinea pig heart. And what Hatton and Hume did is design some very selective antibodies for that particular peptide. And they had some both from the C and the N terminal domain of that channel protein. And so we worked with them, and they looked at the distribution and the density of that channel, and it turns out that there is a large distribution where it's present on the left and much less so on the right. And that's the reason why the left reacts much more strongly to a hypoosmotic, hypotonic condition than the right. And here you see that in this hypoosmotic condition, the frequencies go up and you go from a very complex spectrogram, short time FFT, to a very high frequency FFT. And when you block that current, you go back here. If you look at the right, you only have a slight effect. They do have some channels. It's not totally free or devoid of chloride swell channels. Okay? But the left has more of them. So if you look at the distribution of frequency, this is the XY plane. You see the right and left here are okay, homogeneous, then the frequencies go up on the left, but not on the right. And when you block the current, this is essentially a representation of what different parts of the heart are doing in their FFT or their fibrillating events as a function of osmolarity and chloride channel block. The other thing you can do is to look at local conduction velocities and whether or not you change orientation, or if you have a preferred orientation under condition where you would tend to have a mother rotor. You would get to see this, right? Whereas before, there is no selective orientation. So the next thing we were concerned about is how can a relatively small current, the chloride current, which only has a small effect on action potential duration in a normal heart, have such a huge effect on the dynamics of fibrillation? So we decided to model that, and the model that we chose is the FOX CMV model, where we compared essentially the dynamics of the fibrillation. These are the conditions for the model, and let me just move on. Because it doesn't give complex fragmented VFs. Okay? And you told me why last time. The sodium current is off. So we tried it. Oh yeah, we tried it. And we tried to manipulate it, but then it seemed that the CMV model just did it. And so it seemed safer to just go ahead. And then we inserted, okay? And then we inserted the chloride at the center of the field of the model. So this is a 500 by 500 node 2D sheet. And this is the equation to characterize the chloride swell channel. This we took from Vandenberg et al., who's done a lot of work on single channel currents and what you would expect for that current distribution, for that for the conductance. And then the current was activated at the center, and in order to see if, when we first just changed it everywhere, we couldn't find the mother rotor, actually, in the model. But by having it in the center, then you pin it there, closer to the center, and then decreasing gradually towards the edges of the nodes. Okay? So, if... let me just show you the movie.
Before, what happened when you just put that current everywhere?
It was hard. You would see a single frequency, but you didn't see the spiral.
What was driving? Technically understand that. What was driving the frequency if you don't see a spiral? The 2D sheet was needed to have some sustained activity.
So if this focus, the center of the rotor is off to the side, we had trouble seeing the mother rotor in the field. So this is an experimental This is an experimental movie of what happens to the guinea pig heart when you have the hypoosmotic effect and you have a dominant frequency. And then...
So this is HQ heart?
Yes. And this is the model. Ah, no. Shouldn't stop. I was hoping to get both of them going at the same time. Used to work, sorry. This is the control. You see that there's a lot of fragmentation and creation and annihilation of waves. And,
is that continuously fragmenting, or is that pretty stable in the domains?
It's pretty random. And this may take. Why isn't this one running? This is the more interesting one. Well, let me show you what happens to this one. What happens is that if you. This is the model. This is the model. So you start out with a very the fragmented waves you saw in the other movie. And if you now change osmolarity, or in the case of the model, you turn on the chloride current, you gradually change the nature of the VF, and you stabilize into this after several minutes. So it's a long movie, and maybe it's not worth showing.
Yeah, from the movies, you can see that there's a little thing to that. It's not completely well resolved, so especially.
Right.
So if you're not well resolved, sometimes you may get breakup, and these ones with the small eyes, you may get breakup due to the discretization, but you may not be once you go to a higher resolution. So. I mean, at this point, I don't know, it could be because of the change that you made in the chloride, but it could be also due to the control.
But the control is the same.
Both.
We use exactly the same thing. We just inserted that additional current.
But it doesn't seem to break up.
What doesn't seem to break up?
It doesn't seem to, that doing the movie doesn't seem to have to break up or break.
Oops, okay, let's see. What is this? You mean this one? The left one does show breakups.
Is it rotating faster because of
the side? Yes. Yes.
So
exactly.
If you are suspecting the chloride channel, I thought there is a Walker 89 or something. One would think that if you add the Walker, you would equalize the behavior of the two chambers.
I showed that.
With the Walker?
Yes.
Maybe
I used IA 94, which is a very good blocker.
And the two chambers equalize?
Yeah.
Maybe also.
I can show it to you again. The FFT didn't change. It went back. In fact, you can do it either way. You can either go to hypoosmotic, see the high frequency FFT, right? Single dominant frequency. Block it, it goes back. Or you can add it first, and both ways work. Okay. No, you're absolutely right. That's a very important. So we have pharmacological data. We have right-left distribution of the channel, and we have a model that tries to explain why a single current is able to have such a big impact on the fibrillation. And the reason why we think it can have such a big impact is that when it does open, it's opening not only during the action potential, but the chloride current is open all the time, right? It isn't voltage activated. It isn't calcium activated, it's just swelling activated. So it's on all the time, and it's affecting the resting potential, it's affecting the kinetics of all the depolarization and the repolarization. and because of that, it has a major impact on the VF.
And it rises the resting potential, which currently is hyperpolarized.
It's slight depolarization, but in VF, it's in VF, it's more complicated. Okay. Now, can I switch topics on you?
Will it be possible to view these movies later?
I charge a quarter, that's all.
But we could look at that. I was wondering, you know, this afternoon at 4, you know, we could meet and look at the movie somewhere. There's nothing scheduled, right?
Okay. So do you want to stop now?
No. You should go on. I mean, I just said, in addition to what you have to say today.
Oh. All right. All right, so what have I shown so far in VF? Time domain frequency is very useful to identify coexisting events that are creating annihilating E waves. We can look at this analysis with cross correlation analysis to show that there is coupling and crosstalk between cells, and that the anisotropy that is in the normal heart is retained in the fibrillating heart, and the fact that the correlation as a function of distance is smooth and doesn't show stepping properties is also indicative that a mother rotor is not as likely to occur. And then the last bit is why you can see a mother rotor in times and not others. And it may have to do with swelling of cells, which turns on a volume-regulated chloride current, which is more expressed more in the left than the right ventricle, which accounts for the spatial heterogeneity of this phenomenon. So if I have now convinced you that VF is waves that are constantly created and annihilated, then the next step is to ask the question, what perpetuates this phenomenon? What is the event that really breaks one wave into one or two daughter waves, two or more daughter waves, and where does this happen on the heart, and why? Because if you can stop that from happening, then you can't perpetuate VF, because you have to have the creation of new waves all the time in order to maintain VF. So we started to look at that at higher spatial resolution because the diode array, as was pointed out by a number of people here, at 16 by 16 pixels or 256 total pixels isn't enough to give you the kind of detailed information to analyze the wavefront and identify the location where a wave might break into two daughter waves. So here we change direction a little bit and we use a CMOS camera, which is 100 by 100 pixel. But what this CMOS camera offers that's somewhat different is that it has a very large sensor surface. It's a centimeter. So the pixels are much bigger than standard CCD cameras, which are considerably smaller, which are 2.5-3 millimeter size. And what that means to us from a practical experimental point of view is that if I look at a centimeter and I want to focus a centimeter image on a centimeter image, I can come up close. And my effective numerical aperture of my optical system remains high, and I don't have to demagnify. Because if I demagnify, then my lens is far from the heart and closer to the sensor. And that is very costly in terms of signal-to-noise ratio. Another thing we're looking for is a camera that's particularly speedy. And here we show you essentially signals recorded at 2,000, 5,000, and 10,000 frames a second, single shot, no filtering, no spatial or temporal filtering. This is VF, so let me show you what the action potentials look like as well. I think that's, well, actually, that's not the action potential. That'll come later. this is essentially a wave of propagating across. This is raw data just put into the movie. And then this is, you can see the heart, you can see a blood vessel here, and you can see some fiber structure. And these are the signals that you get from this camera at 2,000, 5,000, and 10,000 frames a second. You can see the worse, the higher noise. It's actually signal to noise because your time to accumulate photons is so much shorter between as you go faster and faster.
How fast are you
I forget, we did that. At 30, at this one, I think it's 2-3 milliseconds. Yeah. And those are, those signals are recorded, so each pixel is looking at 100 by 100 microns of tissue. Okay? It's not a millimeter anymore also. So it's higher resolution and higher speed. Well, no, higher speed, we never had a problem with speed, but it's important to be able to show you that this camera can record at high speed. Because the diodes, yes, they can record at high speed. That's no.
Basically, what it says is that at lower speed, you can have more sensitivity. You have very good signal to noise.
Well, that's at 2,000, yes.
Yeah. And you get high resolution.
Right.
What do you mean by spontaneous AP?
I'm sorry?
Spontaneous. What do you use the word spontaneous?
I think it's under sinus rhythm, that's why.
Okay.
Yeah, that, not paced. Yeah. And those are examples of VF signals, by the way. This is stretched out here, right? The time scale isn't the same because the amount of memory is different. When you go at higher readout rates, you don't get quite. All right. So what happens in VF? Here's an example of a fibrillation on the heart, and you can see the fibers, and those are waves. And what is important that I like to emphasize here is that we measure those waves not by taking a threshold cut across the data. The data is shown up on top, raw F. This is DFDT. The signal-to-noise ratio is sufficiently good, then I can take the first derivative and identify unique activation time points. But without that, you don't get such a nice wavefront. Okay? Other investigators, they have too much noise. If you take the first derivative on the top trace, you can't get a unique time activation time point. And so you have to rely on a line somewhere in the middle of the traces and identify the intercepts as activation time points. And that's not very accurate because you can miss some that are too small and you can be far off on those that are too large with respect to their identifying the precise activation time point. These activation time points are considerably more precise. And that's the point of this slide. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Angle of the signal and stretch them in a way to make sure that they're not missing.
You can't, not when you have noise.
If you worry about the threshold level, you can apply some enveloping function and make sure that you're not missing activation.
If you have an activation point which is twice your the standard deviation of your noise, it's hard. Doesn't matter how much you stretch it.
But you could remove, you know, this amplitude variation just by a complexity modulation technique, and then you take the modulus out, and what you have is the phase signal, and then you could do something, but the question is whether your noise is so high.
If you believe it, okay. I don't. Okay. If you believe it, if you think it works.
No, I'm not saying it works.
Yeah. Okay.
You have to test it, right? You have to make sure.
Right.
You're saying with this camera you can get nothing.
You don't even do that. With this camera, it's not an issue. That's what we do. Anyway, all of these wavefronts are derived that way. Okay. And as you can see, they're very complex. 1 through 10, essentially, if I remember correctly, this is one pixel out of 10,000, right, in the map. and you simply plot these 10 or 10 of these spikes, these 10 activation spikes. Okay, now this point was to show you that on an intact heart, you can start to see the fibrillation waves and the generation and annihilation of waves as a function of time in a guinea pig heart. This is a guinea pig heart. Oh, to get the fibrillation, I think I said it, but I may have forgotten to say it. We put electrodes here, and the same voltage strength that you would to get an action potential, just to capture, we send a burst of pulses with a duty cycle of 50 milliseconds, and they last 2 seconds. And so you put burp and you stop. That's it.
Do you have a movie of how it initiates the VF?
I don't have it here, no. But we published that in 94. In Circ Research. Right now.
How does it initiate the
Yeah, because these bursts start to capture in the relative refractory period and kick it. Yeah, we should do it. You're right. It's slow here, I think.
If your point is that you have another resolution to get a really nice weight from
the DFT. The DFT, yes, exactly.
It's really hard to move.
Right, that was the point, and the movie is not running for some reason. It's running here. You can see it later, I guess. I'm not sure why it's happening.
So the heart doesn't seem to move like that?
Oh, it's in this chamber that I was telling you about. Well, you will see some movies where you'll see the... Yeah, it's... Yes. And some movies show it much better than others, I guess. But yeah, but it does. That's exactly right. So, here what we're trying to show is if you take... If you take, so here's the raw data, the raw image, and you can see the wave of F. This is the FDT. This is a binary image process to accentuate the wave fronts. And whenever there is a wave split, we mark it here. First we go from here to here, where you see the wave front. And then here we identify wave splits. And then we add them up here. Something happened here. Okay.
So the binary threshold for both acceptance and derivative level?
The binary threshold is taken from this. From this image, after the derivative, right? And the binary threshold is done here three times standard deviation to identify the wave front. Then this is transferred into a pixelated wave front. And now you detect wave splits by taking a linear regression analysis of the wave, and as it splits, you identify the minimum point. No, all automated. No, nothing by eye. And when you identify the wave break location, you put it back on the map, on the location of the heart map. Now we can start asking the question, what happened at that point, at the wave break point, to cause the wave break? Okay, but first you have to identify them. And one of the things that the previous slide was supposed to point out is that this is an example of a wave that comes and splits. And notice the time. In 1 millisecond it's fine, 2 milliseconds as a split, 3 milliseconds it's so far away that it's already difficult to identify the wave location, the wave break location.
These are now tips of a spiral, right?
Of a small order, yeah.
Of course, still very well defined. So if you can take a phase map of it, instead of looking just for the grounds, you can look at the phase signal, the time signal. And from the time signal, you can derive where the rotor, with some accuracy, you can decide where that rotor is going to be.
Yeah, but
you can still track that.
But you still need the time resolution.
No, you do. Yeah. Good question.
Right.
The direction of motion of that?
Sorry?
Seems strange to me. Which way is it moving?
It's coming this way.
It's coming that way.
Yeah, this is maybe shifted here. This is an example point out where how quickly they break away.
Okay, because
it should be
invading more.
Right. Not necessarily. If the conduction block, then if all that area is blocked, then it just has to move.
Has to go away from each other.
You're assuming that everything is
excited. I was asking a question.
No, but I was asking a question.
He was helping me.
Yeah.
I hired him to help. That's good.
Thank you. The thing is that
it's possible.
These fields should be shifted relative to each other.
No, it's possible. That's just the way that it's correct, the way it is.
So you're saying that if I had a normal excitable medium and there's a wave break without a and then what we would see is that it moves out.
Right.
If it's blocking, that doesn't tell you that it has to, it's just not propagating to that area.
As far as I know, this is correct, yes. As far as I know, this is correct, the way it is.
So it's continuing.
Instead of keeping this way, just... Right. But let me show you more examples, or you want to... Okay.
So the thing is, I mean that you're also doing a binary imaging there, I think.
Yes.
Because above the red arrow.
Well, you have to all of these are determined by binary imaging. Yes.
Above the red arrow at 2 milliseconds.
Right.
Above the upward going red arrow at 2 milliseconds.
Yeah.
I would have expected that.
It's pulling back. It seems to be pulling back. Is what you're saying? Yes. Yeah. It seems to be. It's possible it's coming from the interior. I don't. Yeah, this doesn't address that issue.
Anybody.
That doesn't address that issue, the interior. Yes. I know people want to go to lunch. So let me. So this, if you want to see it again, we can see it later. But the point that is more interesting to us is what happens at the neighbors where wave break locations are found. And one of the things is that we need to first separate different characteristics that are seen. So sometimes you will see a split by collision of two waves, and 28% of the events were of that nature. And if you look at all the neighbors where the arrow is at the time that that event occurred, they are all very homogeneous. This is not a true wave break, okay? Another kind is a decremental conduction. It's sort of the wave goes really slowly at some point and then progresses. But it's not, again, a wave, an identifiable wave break into two independent daughter waves. And 50% of the events. The interesting events in the sense of split by refractoriness is what we call these. These are the waves that come in and break into clear daughter waves. And you can see this doesn't add up to 100% because there's some we just can't figure it out. Okay, but of these, you see about 34 plus or minus 4 splits per second during a fibrillating Dynegy cart. Okay? And what's interesting is now what happens at the neighbors right near surrounding that location. And one of the striking things that happens consistently when you have a wave breaking into two daughter waves, it seems to be a gradient of repolarization, and it seems to be essentially discordant voltage fronts in all the neighbors. The next slide shows these examples of such splits. So what we try to do here is, it doesn't show, you see this wave is high versus low, and this is low versus high. Here's another example, just prior, the break occurs here, but just before, this is essentially low to the up, and this one. So these different neighbors are going in opposite direction in terms of their relative amplitude. This one is also pretty striking. It's slow and this goes up here. But what is this? So much harder to see than in here.
So where are those recordings?
So those are the traces of the pixels that are around the wave break site. Okay, so we're looking what the neighbors are doing now.
When the wave breaks, meaning that it's continuous in your image, is the red arrow? Or?
Right. The red arrow. So it's saying that the big arrow is where the split occurred, where the wave split occurred. Okay? And then here you can see that they're very discordant. High, low becomes low, high. Immediately, right near, 100 microns away. This is optical signal, not derivative.
Does it mean that the back of the previous wave moves with a very low speed or simply slows?
It's
before this event occurs.
So right before this event occurs, you have very different conditions in terms of, if you want to call it refractoriness, that a wave can't go there because the voltage is high, but it can go the other place where the voltage is low. So it's this differential set of conditions that makes the wave stop here and go in the other direction and proceed and continue. And that may be the reason for wave split. So it's essentially a steep, abrupt gradient of refractoriness, if you will. This way?
You look in the lower trace.
Yeah. Backwards? I'm sorry, here?
No, like if you look at
The first one here?
No, on the lower, on
this
the lower
one?
Trace at 2.7.
Yeah, here.
So if this is, shouldn't it look more like an action potential? Red frontwards?
More like an action potential.
Guys, where am I confused? Yeah.
Yeah.
I have another question. Right now, we're
looking
at multi-pixel tissue.
Right. Yeah.
That's right. And you continue with 100 by 100 pixels.
Right. So each one is 100 by 100 microns.
Each one is 100 by 100 microns.
Right.
And so, average over the area, and that average signal gets to be.
Yeah, these are fluorescence traces. They are raw, they're not.
Right, this is just the raw data. This is our image, so maybe it's not.
Okay, I'm sorry. I guess I'm
confused. Okay.
So, you have not much variation with
that image. That's what I'm trying to say. It's huge.
How many traces are you showing?
Oh, there should be the 8 nearest neighbors. 8 total. Because in other words, the 4 in XY and then the 4 more diagonals. Okay? I should have made that clear, perhaps. So you see the 8 traces that are immediately adjacent to the wave break locations and determined as I showed you in the previous movie, right? So once you identify them, you can go back to the traces and then say what happened there before the wave break. What can we say about that? Yes?
So,
a node of operands, something you long for.
So we are writing the paper now, and we are afraid to use the word node because we're going to get killed, because we can't prove it's a node. It's so short-lived. So if I'm having this discussion with my collaborator Boomrock on that very point, is it fair to call that a node?
But here's the question: if you take a CDM model, exactly the same analysis on the model and see whether there's anything, you know, perhaps people just haven't discovered this, you know, they have these models around, they run them all the time, and they
expect
for analysis, but it might be that the models just behave the same way. I mean, this is the interesting question, is the specific.
Okay. No, but if need be, we can repeat, of course, in other species.
No, I mean,
yeah,
the
yeah, right.
Okay.
Right. Fair. Yeah, so I can show you lots of, the previous one is an example. Here, this is not a break, they're together. Here, there is alternation, but they go together. There isn't this disparity in nearest neighbors. But only when there is this split into daughter waves do you see opposites in the neighbors. The neighbors going in opposite direction. So your question is, let me see if I can reiterate it, is that I need to show that other spots where there is no wave break don't do that. So how do I prove that? The only thing I can do is take other examples, right? When there is a wave front, it's easy. They're the same. Yes, that's not a problem. So there are other events that occur where there's this decremental slowing down in one part of the wave, and then it comes back together. And it's not really a split into new waves. And I can look at that. And that's what we did here in this one. So in trying to so your question is exceedingly important, and we are trying to answer it by trying to compile a set of analysis that will be convincing, and we are struggling with that. Okay. Right.
From this. Three-dimensional vortices. I mean, one thing that, have you measured what fraction of this activation, any time you get a white coming out in a region that was completely black, okay, that's something that you cannot have in two-dimension. Two-dimension, you have a wave break, it's going to come from an existing wave. So if you look at the fraction of activation that comes, you know, where the white in a black region, that will tell you how much is the three-dimensionality important? To me, that would be maybe more interesting than...
I know you want to hear about 3D, but not yet. But you're asking something that
no,
we can't answer here.
No, from your
2D. Oh, okay, then I don't understand your question.
So you could even see it in the movie. You have cases where it's completely black.
Yeah.
And then you see white coming. Right, so topologically, that's something you cannot have in 2D. Unless you have, of course, a focal.
No, I can. Yeah, we are seeing waves appear and disappear. Okay? Some of them appear spontaneously from focal activity. Others may be coming in from below the surface. Both are possible.
Yeah, both are possible. Well, let's assume that there is no focal activity.
But we can't assume. We are pretty convinced that these are happening. They could be happening in depth, but they're happening.
This is exactly the question. We have, of course, a 3D part, but you get some of these fibers would sit in the tissue and they would propagate right to the top.
Mm-hmm.
And then my question is, what does this, how would the statistic change?
Well, yeah, but that's actually what would be interesting.
Well, that's the question. I mean, yeah. You're an experimentalist. You want to make, you know,
yeah, but the way, something, right? The way the discussion was going here with these coronal alters and nodes is to try to look at this wave break with in mind trying to link them to theories that, that look at wave break in dimension.
In
today.
That's,
you know, I don't know how productive that is. Well, that's what you suggested.
Well,
in fact, whether or not the model.
Some of these events will be.
Some are. Yeah.
I'm not sure how much. Looking
at the movie, it really doesn't look like anything. Well, it doesn't look like.
You can definitely find, I mean, at least in our MFM, in your study too, you can find, you know, voices and concepts.
Sure. Look at the movie again and you tell me where you see something that's failure. You want to see another movie?
That's what I want from you.
I mean, I was looking and I couldn't see anything. Let me see if I want to just finish this.
3D, you're right, there are these things coming up like this.
Yeah. So you can plot.
You can look at the movie that, you know, I still show there in my talk, that I don't think it's embarrassing that Flavio did in his thesis, where you had the fiber rotation, and define anybody to try to, you know, see what's going on from just looking at the surface.
Well,
you have complicated filaments, you have breakthroughs.
And if you try to do those
analysis, would be nonsense.
You know, I thought, that's why I said it would be nice to show you the surfaces of the head of the movie that I could show maybe to the phase analysis.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of doing the front analysis, which you have done, we have done the phase analysis, so we have tried to identify the vortices.
Mm-hmm.
And we could just stare at that movie and just not say where it's coming. We could just stare at it and say, how can
right.
we analyze something like this? And
no, I agree. No, I think that's an interesting question.
But
if you have 3D, topologically, you cannot have anything on the surface. There are constraints on what you can get. And I don't think anybody has tried to work them out. I mean, if you have a three-dimensional theoretical activity on the surface, it will be some clear signatures. When there's a
right.
element, there's certain orientation.
So what I'm trying to convince you of here is that wave break locations do not occur at anatomically select positions. They do not occur, and I think that I can say relatively in a compelling way. They do not occur at blood vessels, as was presumed by some people. Because I think here the quality of signal is an issue at blood vessels, and that's not where they occur. Statistically, we can show that the wave break locations that we describe as a wave split into daughter waves occurs where there is a large dispersion of voltage between the neighbors surrounding that location. And one of the challenges was to answer your question, how can I prove that it doesn't happen elsewhere? So we're just compiling statistics on different parts that aren't wave break locations. And I have had some struggles to say what is the best way to make that statistic compelling. But that's something in principle, okay, let's analyze all of them, brute force method. Okay, we can do that. It just takes forever, but we can do it. This one, about 2 cell layers in depth. Yeah. I have very, very narrow depth of field. And what we were discussing with this with Eberhard, if your light source is coming in epi, then your penetration of the light beam is substantial, but if you're shallow, it is not. And in fact, you look at you can see a lot of details in many of the pictures in terms of fibers, because the angle of illumination is shallow. It hits the heart, but it doesn't turn the corner and get in very deep. It gets either reflected off and just illuminates a certain depth. No, it's not subcellular.
Still, 2 cell layers.
Yeah, that's 100 micron, 150 micron. Yeah.
Like, that's the problem. I mean, that's why you have to.
We're developing dyes with long wavelengths.
If you think it would not be 100 microns, what did you say, how many layers you could get in?
what, 350, 380 microns
in depth. Right, still very sharp.
Yeah.
That's not
the cells,
right?
I mean, 150 microns, roughly. Yeah. Oh, that's right. Yeah, you're right. You're right. If they're 20 microns, then it's more like 5 or 8 layers. Yeah, yes. No, more than 2. I'm sorry. They're not oriented this way. They're oriented that way. Yes. Yes. Right. Yes.
You see, your statement is that the break doesn't occur until some homogeneity.
An inhomogeneity of voltages occur at the break, yes.
Okay. But if you recognize some non-homogeneity, simply recognize. So I didn't see on your movie something like, I don't know, the boundary between the left and the right or some.
No, it's not. It's a functional heterogeneity. In other words, it's a very dynamic heterogeneity. It comes from essentially having a big signal and another depolarization coming in very early after a repolarization. So the next one is really small, and some more right next to it, it's large. So it's a function. It's called a functional heterogeneity, and it's very dynamic in nature. It isn't fixed at the same spot all the time, and it's all over the place. That's very correct. And so you didn't see that because it doesn't exist.
See, and when you look at the wave breaks picture, it would be like our stuff, it definitely looks like it's quite homogeneous.
It's quite, yeah. Right. Yeah, that's also heterogeneous. Right. Okay. So for the sake of sanity, this is the superposition of locations and large blood vessels, and there is none. This is an attempt at an analysis of if you measure a wave break at one point, okay, and then you ask the question, what is the number of wave breaks that I'm going to see a certain distance away at different time points. So if you analyze this first at 100 milliseconds later, let's say I measure a wave break here, 100 milliseconds later, where are the wave breaks? And you get this histogram. And you ask that, well, the 20 milliseconds, you get this histogram to try to relate them. And this is basically a random walk distribution. So this also addresses your question in terms of, is there any structure to these wave break locations? Random walk is random walk. That's the kind of distribution you would get. So let me just acknowledge the people who work in my lab, because we can always talk more. And it's important to tell you that Boomrak Choi has been my graduate student and my postdoc, and then he did a lot of work as a research assistant with me, but he's now at Tulane University. And he and I worked very closely on this. And we have some very nice collaborators in the Department of Statistics and Engineering, also at the University of Pittsburgh, who challenged us discussing ways to analyze a lot of these things, such as time frequency domain analysis, a lot of the approaches that we use here to signal process, and they were very helpful to us. We have other collaborators here that are mentioned. This group is a group that we're working with to develop a three-dimensional imager, and we have something cooking there. It's not ready yet, prime time. And that's Fred Lani at Center for Biological Imaging. Lauren Ernst and Alan Wagoner are my collaborators in redesigning and making new voltage-sensitive dyes, potassium probes, and calcium probes. Thank you.
It's a very short question. Did you try Le Sajou?
Le Sajou?
Yes.
No.
Well, there is a way to, you can try and distinguish between mother rotor and independent rotors.
Right.
If it, from different places.
Yeah.
If you do, yes, if you have commensurate frequencies,
right,
and you plot one signal against the other,
right,
after proper filtering, then you'll see
the pattern, yeah,
pictures, and if not, then you just see a cloud.
No, we haven't tried it.
We have tried it in some models and on data from before.
What kind of data do you need to try it on? What is the, what data can we send you to test it if you would like to?
Your recordings. Well,
the raw data is okay?
Well, raw data is okay.
Oh, no problem. We'll show you how to read it too with the software.
Okay. Try.
Yeah. If you, I mean, that's perfect. No, thank you. It's a great idea.
There's a pretty cool mass of people interested to look at movie and
patient.
Thank you.
Thank you.